Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Kevin, let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today, we have Dr. Jeffrey Matthews, Chair of Surgery at the University of Chicago, who's going to be talking to us about surgical education, social media, and he's also going to take us through the surgical management of chronic pancreatitis. But first, our opening shot. So today with Dr. Matthews, we're going to talk about the surgical management of chronic pancreatitis. But in our opening shot today, we just want to take it a step back and look at what chronic pancreatitis is, how we diagnose it, how we treat these patients, and the workup we do before we consider surgical management. So John, what is chronic pancreatitis?
Yeah, Kevin, most people define chronic pancreatitis as a continuing chronic inflammatory process of the pancreas that is characterized by irreversible morphologic changes. In chronic pancreatitis, a lot of people will have impairment of endocrine and exocrine function of the pancreas.
Yeah, so it's a general fibrosis of the pancreas.
So Kevin, what signs and symptoms do patients typically present with?
So the vast majority of patients are going to present with abdominal pain. And this can be pretty severe abdominal pain. It can be related to food, but sometimes it's not always related to food. Many of these patients will have weight loss and steatorrhea chronically with these. And the pain is generally a mid-epigastric or left upper abdominal pain that radiates in a band-like fashion or even can be localized to the mid-back.
So Kevin, what are the etiologies of chronic pancreatitis?
The vast majority are related to alcoholism, 60 to 70%. There's approximately 20 to 30% of patients that have idiopathic chronic pancreatitis, and 10% are due to rare diseases such as cystic fibrosis of the pancreas. When it comes down to it, pancreatitis is a clinical diagnosis, but there are anatomic and functional tests you can do to help determine if this patient does have chronic pancreatitis. When you look at the functional tests or the lab test, you can look at an amylase and lipase levels. These may be slightly elevated in chronic pancreatitis, but if they're high levels, you should be considering this patient likely has acute pancreatitis. Low levels of serum trypsin is relatively specific for advanced chronic pancreatitis, but it is not sensitive enough to be helpful in most patients with mild to moderate disease.
In addition to function tests, there's also ways to evaluate the anatomy during chronic pancreatitis. This is typically done using imaging tests such as CT scans and MRI scans to evaluate the pancreas and the changes in pancreatic ducts. ERCP provides another modality for physicians to accurately visualize the pancreatic ductal system and has been regarded as a criterion standard for diagnosing chronic pancreatitis. In addition to ERCP, MRCP also is very useful in planning surgical or endoscopic interventions. Endoscopic ultrasonography also gives physicians a way to visualize the pancreatic ducts to evaluate for any cysts or possible masses in the pancreas. The overlying theme of all of these imaging modalities is to determine the extent of pancreatic ductal dilatation, as well as determine any calcifications and stones that may be present to help determine medical versus surgical management. So Kevin, what is your approach to treatment and management of patients with chronic pancreatitis?
Well, first you want to start with behavior modification. If the patient drinks or smokes, you need to get them to stop drinking and smoking to allow the pancreas to heal itself. Once you have tackled that, you can move on to pain medication. And unfortunately, many of these patients have such horrible pain because the pancreatic ducts are obstructed by strictures and stones that causes increased duct pressure and pain, that a lot of them are on chronic narcotics to deal with the pain. But you want to consider newer medications such as exogenous pancreatic enzymes and CCK to help alleviate the pain. It is thought that the stimulation of the pancreas is what causes the pain. So by providing these exogenous pancreatic enzymes, it decreases the stimulation of the pancreas and therefore decreases the pain. And there's other things you can go to if none of these methods are working or the patient is not a surgical candidate, and it's the celiac ganglion block. And these are seen also in patients with unresectable pancreas cancer and have shown to be very useful. They use a percutaneous or endoscopic celiac nerve block with either alcohol or steroids.
And after you've exhausted all your medical therapy options for treating chronic pancreatitis, there is also more invasive measures that we can use to treat this disease. Endoscopic therapy is one large modality that aims at decompressing an obstructive pancreatic duct and can offer pain relief in up to 60% of well-selected patients. And by well-selected patients, we mean patients that have chronic pancreatitis due to papillary stenosis, pancreatic duct strictures, and pancreatic duct stones.
And because this is Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, there are also surgical options. And that is why we have our expert in the field, Dr. Jeffrey Matthews, that we're going to hear from later about the surgical options in treating chronic pancreatitis. All right, you know what that sound means. It's time for our random fact of the day. John, what is your greatest fear in life?
Well, Kevin, I think of all my greatest fears, I think pooping on an airplane is probably up there.
It's very high up there for me myself. But did you know you could be contributing to the greater scientific good by taking a poop on an airplane?
No way. How is that?
Well, they actually did a study in Copenhagen where they looked at 18 different airplanes that arrived in Copenhagen from different places around the world, and they actually examined the poop for presence of salmonella and C. diff.
Sounds like a resident job to me. Why would they ever want to do that?
Well, it's interesting. They were able to find different global health trends by looking at this poop. They found that salmonella was most prevalent in poop arriving from Southeast Asia, while the sludge arriving from planes in North America was more likely to contain C. diff. And then actually the planes from Asia had the highest rate of drug-resistant bacteria strains overall.
Wow, that actually seems like a great way to start tracking disease spread across the world. I wonder if the CDC should look into that.
Yeah, so the next time you are locked in a cramped airplane bathroom during turbulence, taking a poop, remember, you are contributing to science. And that has been your random fact of the day.
Thank you, Kevin. All right, now let's scrub in and get to the belly of this podcast.
So welcome, everybody, to another segment of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Jeffrey B. Matthews, who's the chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Chicago, Medicine and Biological Sciences. Dr. Matthews, thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure.
So I've had the pleasure of meeting you a few times, sir, and kind of had the pleasure of going through things. But for those people who may not know as well, can you walk us through a little bit about where you're from, kind of how it came to the point where you trained to the point where you came to the University of Chicago?
Well, that's a lot of time. I'm originally from New York and did my early schooling there, but then moved to Boston where I did undergraduate and medical school at Harvard, trained at the Beth Israel Hospital under Dr. William Seilin. Got me my start in research, and then finished training there and stayed on faculty for about 10 years. I was recruited to the University of Cincinnati to lead that department for 5 years, had a wonderful experience there, but was ultimately recruited to the University of Chicago in 2006, where I've been ever since.
That's fantastic. So, sir, one of the things that you have been remarkable at doing is to be able to do some basic science along with your clinical busy service. How do you manage to balance between running a basic science, balancing that with surgery, research, and then be a chairman of a major university?
So it's this is not easy, and in fact, this has changed over time. I started doing basic bench research after I finished, well, actually started doing it back in college and medical school, but then went into the lab directly after finishing my clinical training and was largely in the lab for the first 2 years of my practice. Developed some really interesting lines of research dealing with fundamental epithelial biology. I had great mentors in William Seilin and James Madera at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and that turned into my research grants. And I found that the balancing act between running a basic science lab and clinical practice was not only energizing, but it allowed me to, in a funny way, focus intensely on both, and I found them really synergistic in a kind of way. Now, as things go on, I was a chairman at the University of Cincinnati, maintained my lab, and moved it again to the University of Chicago. It gets harder and harder to do that as your roles and responsibilities become more about creating the opportunities for the rest of the department. So I actually, in the last 2 years, my own basic investigation has been substantially downsized in favor of putting resources into my department's research programs and trying to get new investigators and new lines of research started there, sort of creating the culture of that. It's no longer really as important for me to continue my own basic research as it is to ensure that we're doing high quality basic and translational research within the Department of Surgery, really spanning from the bench to the bedside, outcomes, quality, et cetera.
So, sir, at the University of Cincinnati, you were known for quadrupling the medical student applicants to general surgery. I know a lot of institutions, med students are actually really afraid of their general surgery rotation, and it's something they dread. How did you go about increasing the interest in general surgery?
So I'm not sure that it was a targeted activity. I don't remember a conversation that I had that said we have to increase the number of medical students choosing surgery. What I tried to do was to create a modern culture within the Department of Surgery in Cincinnati, one that felt more inclusive, one that tried to address perhaps generational changes in terms of what residents, students, and young faculty responded to. We tried to really work on the entire department culture, and I think a byproduct of that was students having a much better experience on their general surgery rotations and being inspired to pursue it. We tried to get the surgical faculty more involved in earlier years in the evolution of the medical students' experience there, getting them involved in the anatomy lab, hosting some research electives and so forth. But I think that that was really just part of being more institutional citizens rather than any direct goal. We found that, you know, to our satisfaction, that we really did stir up a lot of interest in surgery.
So one of the things we've learned about you in preparing for this interview is that you're quite active on social media, and we've really enjoyed reading some of your Twitter feeds. Why do you stay plugged in, and what do you view the role of social media as far as surgery goes and as far as surgical education goes?
Well, I'm learning, and it's sort of evolving as we, you know, as the months and years pass. I got involved in social media really on behalf of my department. I started a feed basically in probably 2009, I would say, for the Department of Surgery here at the University of Chicago, where I started posting about interesting things that were going on. And then I started to really enjoy the experience and began to turn that more into my own stuff. Started more of a formal Department of Surgery Twitter feed that was separate from my personal feed, really have enjoyed a number of aspects of it. I feel like it allows you to, you know, sort of increase visibility and join conversations on lots of different topics of importance. You know, people view a department chairman as a thought leader, as some sort of trusted authority. So if I weigh in on issues that are relevant in surgery or healthcare in general, that might be useful to people. I felt like I could represent the department and institution, but also to maybe humanize myself, to make increase my accessibility. One of the most fun things I've experienced on Twitter, for example, is being able to communicate with a whole range of surgical trainees and students. You know, I'll go around and give a visiting professor lecture at some institution, and someone will come up to me and say, "Hey, I follow you on Twitter," and I go, "Oh, I know who you are, and we've had conversations on Twitter before," and then meeting them in real life is, you know, that would never happen otherwise. You know, I think just giving people a sense of your personality, and look, I can't help but commenting on pop culture and other sorts of things that I find interesting.
Speaking of which, sir, Dr. Shirley of Ohio State wanted us to ask you, what the Pitchfork Fest lineup is this year, and are you going?
I'm definitely going. I always go to Pitchfork. It's a great music festival. Wilco is headlining this year on Friday night, so I'm very excited about that. I've probably seen them a dozen times. It's always a good show, and there's a lot of other bands. I've forgotten the rest of the lineup. It's online. I enjoyed the summer festival season in Chicago. It's really one of the hidden gems of the place, whether it's Lollapalooza to Riot Fest. They're just so much fun, and all the different street festivals. I have a good time. I know it's totally age inappropriate for me to be there. That's a lot of fun.
I love it.
You know, I got to say, though, that this was one of our first Twitter live questions to ask our guests. So this has been a really fun thing for us, too, to have our followers reach out to you through us to be able to ask you the question. So that's been great. Dr. Matthews, have you had any backlash in terms of social media? Has anybody come to you and said, I don't like that, yada, yada, and kind of it's gone the opposite angle, or something that you had sparked a little bit of controversy on the academic side?
Well, you know, there's Twitter, you know, you got to sort of get in the swing there. There's always going to be trolls there, and occasionally there'll be something that you get trolled for, and it can be a little bit amusing. I try to keep things professional, but you know, if you're putting an opinion out there, somebody's going to disagree with you, and that's okay. I don't think there's been too much backlash. I think largely, almost universally positive, really received, and I enjoy the interactions.
So do you think this is something that that a lot of surgery, I mean, we notice more and more surgery departments or residencies, a thing, are on to Twitter, but how much do you think that social media is going to play in the future in terms of not only surgical education, but advertising and just the whole realm of surgery?
Well, I think social media is changing a lot of things, and there's a lot of different reasons that people engage in it, from just, you know, wanting to comment about the Chicago Blackhawks game or something like that, to talking about issues in surgery. There's many journals that have started Twitter journal clubs or discussions through that venue. Everybody's got a Facebook page, and I think these are sometimes helpful. There certainly are communities of patients that are out there, and being able to engage with large groups of stakeholders, whether they're patients or other other parties, is useful. I think that social media is really changing the whole field of peer review and the way research or advances in clinical practice get disseminated. So I think that it's probably, you know, while impact factor of the journal that you publish your paper in is relevant to academic promotion committees, the impact that your work has in generating conversations, whether it is downloads or hits to a website or social media mentions, is another important way to measure what we do and how important our science and our clinical advances are.
One of the other many hats that you wear is the co-editor of the Journal of Gastrointestinal Surgery. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you got into that particular role, and maybe some tips for reviewers out there who want to ascend through the hierarchy of academic journals?
Sure. I got involved in the Journal of Gastrointestinal Surgery through my role in the, or really participation in the Society for Surgery of the Alimentary Tract, which owns the journal. The SSAT is one of the four organizations that make up Digestive Diseases Week, and since I was a medical student, I've been going to that meeting to present research and to learn from surgeons and gastroenterologists and endoscopists. It's a fabulous, huge meeting that meets in May every year. The SSAT is an organization that I was involved in really from the very beginning of my career as a student and then a resident. I got a career development award from them, so I was always very tuned into their activities. The journal was founded by John Cameron and Keith Kelly, and as their tenure as editors advanced, they brought on two associate editors, myself and Charles Yeo, who's now the chairman at Jefferson. And Charlie and I were the associate editors together with John Cameron and Keith Kelly for many years. And then when they stepped away, Charlie and I stepped into the editor's role. So it was a gradual thing. I think I got tapped to do that because I had always prioritized journal reviews, participating in that process. I felt that that was an important part of being an academic surgeon, so I always enjoyed being asked to review manuscripts and was asked to be on a number of editorial boards over time, I think because I wrote good reviews. So you asked, you know, what advice do I have out there? For first of all, is when you're asked to review, say yes. It's very, very important. I'm always struck by, you know, getting an email from an author saying, how come my paper hasn't been reviewed yet? It's been delayed. And that author was somebody who turned down the request to review another article. And so the paradox there. I think everybody, it's their duty to participate in peer review when you're asked. Do everything you can to try to write a review, and then try to make the review substantive. Try to bring your expert opinion or expert voice to that, and give the editors something and the authors some clear, meaningful feedback on their work. Again, I think reviewing for medical journals is one of the real privileges of being an academic surgeon.
Well, sir, now it's time for our dissection of the day. This is the segment in which we delve more in depth about a particular surgical topic. And today, with you, we would like to discuss the surgical management of chronic pancreatitis. So I was wondering if you could just talk to us a little bit about, you know, the trends that you're seeing in your practice as far as how are patients presenting, you know, what's the etiology and the epidemiology behind this? How you go about working up these patients when they initially present to you, and how do you decide, you know, who may benefit from a surgical intervention?
So I think we've learned a lot about pancreatitis over the last several decades. One of the things that's been fascinating to see is while the disease is often stigmatized as a disease of alcoholics, we've learned that the vast majority of individuals who abuse alcohol really don't develop pancreatitis, and there's a subset who do, probably because of a genetic background that makes them susceptible to it, and we're learning more about that. We're also learning that many patients are stigmatized that the etiology of their pancreatitis is through alcohol use, when in fact it is a hereditary or genetic basis for it, whether it's through mutations in genes such as PRSS1 or the cystic fibrosis gene or other contributing factors. So we're seeing more and more patients who don't have that classical story. We're also seeing patients earlier in their course of disease because there are more therapies that can be offered, whether endoscopically or surgically, to address the symptoms of pain. We're also learning more about the pathology that can coexist with chronic pancreatitis or recurrent acute pancreatitis, and whether patients have an underlying mucinous cystic neoplasm, such as interductal papillary mucinous neoplasm, side branch or main duct disease, and there are other considerations that are coming in. So we're seeing a real spectrum of patients that the old textbooks really didn't talk about before. So we're seeing them more. The evaluation has become increasingly multidisciplinary in nature. It's important that we have good working relationships with medical pancreatologists, which, by the way, are a rare breed, interventional endoscopists, which are not a rare breed, and then radiology as well. And so we try to do a multidisciplinary approach when we're seeing these patients to try to figure out what the best range of options are. They can still be an extremely difficult group of patients to really solve their problems. And trying to get them into programs earlier rather than later for smoking cessation and other sorts of important interventions is helpful. We're also learning more about how complex pain is and how difficult it is to address all of the different possible reasons that a patient can experience pain in the setting of recurrent acute or chronic pancreatitis.
Sir, can you touch on when these patients are referred to you, how much of a medical therapy have they undergone, endoscopic therapy, or do they come to you earlier on? Kind of when are you seeing these patients, and what have they done before you consider surgery?
Yeah, so it's highly variable when they'll come to me. Sometimes I'll get patients after a single attack of pancreatitis, and somebody took out their gallbladder, but they had a second attack, and they want to know what's going on. Other times you'll see patients at a very late stage after they've been managed by other providers, often in multiple institutions over a long period of time. So it's very hard to generalize about how they come. In terms of how do I decide what the surgical role should be, I think the most important thing to start with is, you know, God forbid, a careful history and really understand the evolution of the disease and what's been done for them before in terms of evaluation and management. What's worked? How long did it work for? What approaches have happened? It's amazing to me how often, for example, the patient's symptoms are ascribed to the pancreatitis when in fact the symptoms are more due to the pancreatic exocrine insufficiency and the patient hasn't been adequately managed on pancreatic enzyme therapy. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable how often that's the case. So a patient will complain of postprandial pain, and when you really talk to them and you understand what it is, it's more of a gas, bloating, and discomfort due to exocrine insufficiency rather than chronic deep-seated pain that needs narcotics. But they'll often get, you know, be seen in emergency rooms, get prescribed narcotics. Sometimes they'll get prescribed pancreatic enzymes and they won't be told how to take them. So I would say that I'm the hero extremely often because I can tell patients, don't take your pancreatic enzymes, you know, four times a day, take them actually with the meals, mixing them with the food. And it's like this revelation that happens, and all of a sudden their symptoms can be made better. So I think you have to do a lot of those kinds of things. And it's amazing how the patients fall between the cracks before they come in to see us, where this really hasn't been explained to them. So that's a really important thing. You know, the choice between endoscopic interventions versus surgical interventions, there's a subset of patients who are amenable to either, and there are advantages and disadvantages with an early surgical approach versus endoscopic temporization. I think the randomized prospective studies that have tried to compare the two have clearly shown that surgery is more effective for providing sustained pain relief without the need for additional interventions. But the fact remains that patients want to avoid surgery if possible, and so you have to really go with the flow a little bit there and consider a range of different options. Again, we have a weekly multidisciplinary pancreatic conference where we review this together with our team and try to select the best approach.
And kind of, you know, on that topic, you know, we're always taught, you know, when you operate on pain, typically you're not that optimistic about the outcomes. How do you, you know, this is an area where you are operating for pain. How do you counsel those patients, and what kind of outcomes are you seeing?
So first of all, the main reason that we would be involved in a patient, 95% of the time you're operating for pain. It's not for obstruction or other complications. You're operating for pain. And I think there has to be an understanding, or at least a hypothesis in your mind, as to what is the source of the pain, because the choice of the operation has to somehow reflect why you think the patient is having pain. So the patient with large duct disease or a large pseudocyst, you know, decompression procedures make sense, whereas patients who have a large inflammatory head mass, you're thinking more in terms of resection, and you think that it's the inflammation and the stimulation of local nerves somehow that is, contributing to the pain. You know, those are hand waves, but they seem to have some relationship to the outcome of how the patients do. I try to set realistic expectations. I don't think that you can ever assure the patient that pain is going to be solved, even patients who ultimately come to total pancreatectomy. Not all of them have relief of pain. So I never quote more than an 80% chance. And you have to agree with the patient about the plan for tapering narcotics and eventually, ceasing narcotics. And that's really it's not like you just do the operation and you're done. There's a real commitment that you have to make together with the patients and their families to try to reduce the dependence.
For imaging for these patients, are you relying more on the functional, quasi-functional studies of the ERCPs, or are you going straight to MRCPs, ultrasound? Kind of how are you working these?
So I think ERCP is only meaningful if there's a therapy planned with it. As a general rule, as a diagnostic modality, it's not helpful. It's not that it's not helpful, is that it's been supplanted by better ways to look at the pancreas. So I think that MRCP, with or without secretin stimulation, is much more relevant, gives you all of the same information, and helps you to understand the anatomy and the situation there. So we certainly favor that. Endoscopic ultrasound can be very helpful as well. So ERCP is really restricted to patients where there's a specific therapy planned.
And sir, can you touch on the secretin stimulation for the MRCP?
So for MRCP, if you a functional MRCP involves the infusion of secretin, so you can see whether the pancreas generates fluid in response to secretin, and whether there's a stricture that looks like it's functionally meaningful. That can be really helpful in patients with early disease or with ambiguous disease, or where there's a patient where you're not sure whether there is a functionally relevant stenosis. So we find it very helpful. It also gives you better imaging because it fills out the ducts much better.
Are they doing like a pre and a post when they do that MRI, or is it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I was wondering if you could take us through, some of the different surgical options. We hear about the Pousteau procedure versus the Frey versus, a resection. What goes into your decision-making process in reaching for one over the other, based on how the patient presents, what the etiology of their chronic pancreatitis is, and just how you go about that algorithm. And if you could, just throw in, a quick description of each of the procedures that you have in your toolbox.
Sure. So I think about the procedures in two broad categories, decompressive procedures and resection procedures. And then there are procedures that are sort of combinations of the two. I look at each patient and try to decide whether, from a structural anatomic standpoint, will they benefit more from a decompressive approach or from a resection approach. Is as much of a hunch as it is a science. So the pure decompressive procedure would be more like a Pousteau procedure, a lateral pancreatic jejunostomy, which doesn't involve the resection of any pancreatic tissue. It involves longitudinally opening the pancreatic duct throughout its length, well up into the head, removing any stones, trying to get your way through any strictures, trying your best to evacuate the stones from the bile from the pancreatic duct if you can, and then sewing it in side-to-side fashion to a Roux-Y conduit of jejunum. So that's a very straightforward procedure. Patients who have a dense concentration of calcifications or inflammation or intrapancreatic pseudocyst or this sort of anatomy might be more amenable to a resection procedure. I think the tried and true approach is a Whipple procedure, pancreatic duodenectomy, which can be highly effective. In Europe, pancreatic head resections that spared the duodenum were developed, first by Hans Beger, and then a variety of sort of variations on that. Beger procedure was really a pure duodenum sparing pancreatic head resection, where then a Roux-Y loop is brought up and pancreatic jejunostomy is sewn, much like a Whipple pancreatic jejunostomy would be performed. Then there are variations on that. So the Frey procedure involves a limited coring out of the pancreatic head, again sparing the duodenum, and that's combined with a longitudinal unroofing of the main pancreatic duct. And so that Roux-Y conduit gets sewn to the not only along the length of the pancreatic duct, but also to that that coring out that you've done in the pancreatic head. I say that it sort of looks like you when you finished doing the resection portion and the unroofing of the pancreas, it looks like you could fit a Tootsie Pop into the pancreas there. And if that's that's sort of what the shape of it is there, and you sew a Roux loop up there. That's a Fry procedure. There are other variations of that, the burn variation, which is the limited coring out of the pancreatic head without the longitudinal pancreatic duct unroofing, and that can work as well. A number of prospective randomized studies have tried to compare the Whipple procedure versus duodenum pancreatic head resections, or tried to compare the different types of duodenum sparing pancreatic head resections, and most of the data show that it's a pick-em sort of thing. There's pluses and minuses with each approach, and it really depends upon the surgeon's individual experience with it. I tend to do more Fry type procedures or duodenum sparing head resections than I do Whipples, but that's just my experience. I think the results are very similar.
Dr. Matthews, is there any minimally invasive approaches to any of these ones? Are people doing it? Do you do it?
Yeah, so I think that there are instances where you can do some of these procedures laparoscopically. You could do a distal pancreatectomy. You could drain a large pancreatic pseudocyst. We do that all the time by minimally invasive techniques. When you're dealing with a rock-hard, horrible pancreas, even when that thing is open, it feels like you're sort of chiseling it out with a jackhammer sometimes. I think that's difficult to do by minimally invasive approaches. Maybe in earlier disease that's possible. I just find the peripancreatic inflammation or the texture of the duct to be sometimes extremely rough going, and so I don't tend to endorse that approach for patients with with the real medium to end stage chronic pancreatitis. But I think it can be done in limited circumstances.
Sir, one thing I've noticed through the literature that University of Chicago is known for is the auto transplantation of the pancreas. Can you describe kind of the concept behind this and how you guys developed this?
So I didn't develop it. This is a procedure that we do. So there's a set of patients who have so we described the patient with large duct pancreatitis might be amenable to a decompressive procedure, or a patient that has an inflammatory head mass or a pseudocyst might be amenable to a resection procedure. There's a whole subset of patients that have more complex situations. Maybe they have small duct disease that without an associated inflammatory head mass. Maybe they've had a prior surgical procedure but now have recurrent disease. Or maybe they have a genetic predisposition, such as a hereditary pancreatitis associated with a PRSS1 gene mutation that carries a higher risk of developing pancreatic cancer. In this subset of patients, the idea of doing a completion or a total pancreatectomy has been around since the 1960s, when this has been done for end-stage chronic pancreatitis. The results are about 70% of patients can have either resolution of their pain or at least substantial improvement of their pain in that subset of patients. The problem was that complete removal of the pancreas had not only severe exocrine insufficiency associated with it, but type 3C diabetes, which could be very difficult to treat on standard insulin therapy. People who have type 3C diabetes, no pancreas basically, are very sensitive to exogenous insulin, and they're susceptible to symptomatic hypoglycemia, and that can be actually dangerous and difficult to control. So a lot of research in the 70s led by the Minnesota group, and John Najeri and David Sutherland are sort of the two most significant individuals who really brought this forward, as well as groups at Hopkins, developed ways of isolating islets out of resected pancreas pancreases, pancreata, and then infusing those isolated islets into the portal vein, where they basically endembolize the portal vein tributaries and set up shop in the liver. The techniques for this really developed into sort of the late 1990s, early part of the last decade, where a number of groups, particularly the Minnesota group and our group in Cincinnati, at least in the United States, had the largest experience of doing total pancreatectomies with preservation, autologous islet transplantation. It's important to just side note, it's often, this is auto transplantation. This is rescuing the patient's own islets and giving them back. There's no immunosuppression needed. It's not allo transplantation of islets. And the results are, in the appropriately selected patients, are actually pretty reasonable for a pretty desperate group of patients. So in well-selected patients, you can get about 75%, maybe 80% complete pain relief, and you know, it's measured by either narcotic independence or at least minimal trivial doses, really a dramatic quality of life improvement. About 40% of patients in the early going can be insulin independent. Most patients will have a degree of diabetes and will require exogenous insulin, but it tends to be much easier to control, less labile, since they have some islet function preserved and some counter-regulatory function that's there. So, you know, in selected patients, it's the right thing to do. I think the key is making sure that you select the patients well.
Where do you retransplant these cells to? The liver or?
So the islets. So we have a cGMP facility. When the pancreas is removed, our lab is run by Dr. Piotr Witkowski. Dr. Witkowski takes the islets to the pancreas to the lab, does a collagenase perfusion and separation, shaking out the islet cells, depending upon how the state of the pancreas, you may or may not need to do some partial purification of those, and so resuspended in albumin solution, and then I directly infuse them into the portal vein. So I usually will take the little splenic vein tributary or the splenic vein, throw a little purse string suture in there, put a 14-gauge angiocath in, and we perfuse them in over about a half hour, 45 minutes. They set up shop in the liver, and the function is sustained there. They're seeing portal blood, which is helpful. And so we do detailed metabolic testing of the patients, and while they have they don't have completely normal glucose tolerance mixed meal responses, they actually have pretty good ones there, and they have got well preserved function.
Well, that ends our dissection of the day, and now it's time for our tips and tricks. Today with Dr. Matthews, we're going to focus on the end product, if you will, of the chronic pancreatitis or some other cases of the patient with necrotizing pancreatitis. So, sir, can you walk our listeners through a little bit about maybe some tips and tricks of dealing with those patients? You get in there, they have the necrotic pancreas. How do you debride that pancreas? Where do you lay your drains? And how do you deal with that pesky pancreatic bleeding?
Okay, so let's take a step back. So we're operating on fewer and fewer patients in the acute phase with necrotizing pancreatitis. I think that emerging literature and really well-done studies from the Dutch collaborative group and others have really shown that we should be delaying intervening on patients with necrotizing pancreatitis wherever possible. I think that the order of the day is to delay, drain, and then debride, and there's a lot fewer patients that you have to debride in the emergency acute phase than we used to. It's really limited to that group of patients who need a decompressive laparotomy because of abdominal compartment syndrome, and it's a very small subset these days. Having said that, if I'm doing an open debridement of the pancreas, it's a difficult procedure in the sense that there you feel that it's a little bit blind. I think it's important to be gentle, to not have a compelling need to debride every last bit of tissue, because then it's when you can get into some very bad bleeding. But to get what comes easily and not to be overly aggressive. There really isn't much of a lesser sac to get into, but that's often the first place that you go. But then you might have to be debriding pumping and getting into the paracolic gutters, et cetera, and trying to open up those spaces in multiple ways. You know, so we try to do this minimally invasively whenever possible, usually through percutaneous catheters that are inserted into the flank, into the relevant collections, and then using those tracks to dilate up and do some sort of get a large trocar in there, sort of a 15 trocar, and through a sort of coaxial dissection approach, try to get in there, debride, irrigate. You know, it's easy to stir up bleeding. Small bleeding, you can usually just sort of leave alone and it'll stop. If you get serious bleeding, we usually have our interventional radiologists alerted to the fact that we might have an issue. I would say that fewer and fewer patients require surgical debridement. We are now favoring hybrid therapy with endoscopic transgastric drainage and percutaneous drainage and irrigation, and find that many of those patients will get well without the need for an aggressive surgical debridement.
How has the role of antibiotics changed in terms of severe pancreatitis, borderline necrotizing pancreatitis?
Yeah.
When do you institute them? What are you using? And when, you know, the sterile versus infected, that whole argument in the past.
I think the sterile and infected distinction is no longer as relevant as it used to be, in the sense that I don't think that lengthy attempts to figure out whether a patient is infected or not really matter. I think the appearance of unwellness, appearance of infection is enough to go by. I think that the idea of using early antibiotics initiated, you know, shortly after the onset of necrotizing pancreatitis, that prophylactic use of antibiotics has largely fallen by the wayside because of concern of overuse of antibiotics in general. So most centers have abandoned that. They're really, you know, while there are a couple of trials with very narrow inclusion criteria that can show a small benefit to preventing infection or limiting mortality, in the real world application, prophylactic antibiotics probably aren't valuable, and the downstream effects of antibiotic resistance and so forth, I think, outweighs their use. So in that early sort of delay phase where we're delaying or draining patients who have the appearance of infection, we start with percutaneous drainage and then do culture-directed antibiotic therapy. Try to avoid just blasting with big guns and antifungals just because you can't figure out anything else to do. We try to do incremental steps and try to avoid doing broad antibiotic therapy that's not culture directed.
Fantastic. And that ends our tips and tricks segment.
All right. So we round out every interview with the final five. These are five quick and easy questions for you. Number one, if I was to listen to your, or if I was to open your iPod, what would be the most frequently played? Do you listen to music while you're operating in the OR?
So my music library is like is archival. That's been a hobby of mine since I was like nine. Was sort of collecting music. So there's it's ridiculous what's on my iPod. I have a playlist that's specifically for the OR. That's you know, got a couple of thousand songs on it. That's selected so that it's not going to offend anybody. But it's got a broad list of it's got a broad range of music. It'll be everything. From, you know, 1930s blues or 1950s bop to Led Zeppelin or the Beastie Boys. I mean, it's everything. I would say the most common things that are on there are going to be the bands that I grew up with, you know, the Kinks, the Stones, you know, T-Rex, that sort of stuff. David Bowie's all over it.
Nice.
But then there's a lot more modern stuff. You know, there's Radiohead there, there's Wilco, there's all that stuff. And so, I do listen to music in the OR. I think it sort of creates a nice atmosphere. I enjoy it. And, you know, if it's distracting at a critical point in the operation, we just turn it off.
So as a fellow you know, music connoisseur and reader of Pitchfork, what's been your favorite band that's come out in the last couple of years?
Favorite band in the last couple of years? Let's see, you got me on that. There's so many good bands. I like bands like White Denim, you know, I think about bands that are coming out in recent years. I don't know. You're going to have to maybe pull up my iPad here. let's see.
Carly Rae Jepsen?
Yeah. So actually, so our band covers one of her songs. So I like her a lot too. But I have to say, every time I think of a new band, it's like a band that's already been out for 5 or 8 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I go to the shows to look at new bands, and I don't know. You got me on that one.
All right.
Number two, sir. Do you have any hobbies, interests, or talents outside of the operating room that you could tell us about?
So, I collect guitars. I like to play guitars. That's a big deal for me. That's probably my biggest is music.
What's your favorite guitar that you have?
Oh boy, I got so many of them at this point. It's hard to know. I have a guitar I probably play most often is by a German company called Framus, which basically is their version of a hollow body Gibson 335. You know what I'm talking about. But it's a really beautiful black sort of matte finish with a Bigsby. It's beautiful.
So tell the audience the name of your band, how often you play, what type of things you play in, and what type of music it is.
Well, so I don't really play in as much of a band as I used to play in. We gig out, but we have a hospital-based band, which has some folks from the Department of Surgery, a couple of medical students, an OR nurse, one of our researchers, and we call ourselves Turnover Time, we have a good time. We just played a hospital gig, and we played everything from Carly Rae Jepsen to the Black Crowes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Number three, can you tell us about a favorite vacation or trip that you've taken?
A favorite vacation or trip. I would say my wife and I have occasionally done vacations where we've gone to rock and roll fantasy camps. Those are often fun when we meet rock stars and get to play with them and have a lot of good stories to tell about that. We also go on family trips. We love to go skiing. We love to ski out at Snowmass. We've done some European cruise kind of things as well, which has been really spectacular. Just got back from Israel, actually, which was a great trip.
Would what bands did you go on the rock and roll one with, the fantasy?
Oh, they sort of all, these tend to be a lot of bands that I grew up with, or bands from the 70s, 80s, 90s, that sort of thing. So it's everything from playing with Roger Daltrey of The Who to Kip Winger of the hair metal band Winger, and Hudson Brothers, and these guys, some really good friends. Earl Slick is become a really great friend from David Bowie and John Lennon's band, and so.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
Lots of good stuff.
Number four, if you didn't become a surgeon and didn't go into medicine, what other career path would you have chosen?
Well, what would I have done if I could have done it? I would have been a musician. But I'm long on enthusiasm, short on talent. other than that, when I was in college, I was really interested in art history. I was seriously thinking about going into museum work. Being a curator was something I was really interested in, but that didn't happen.
All right, great, sir. Number five, and our last question. This actually also was requested by Karan Chabara on Twitter. He was wanting to know some intern advice. So if you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice, your intern year, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
One piece of advice. I would say try to learn in the context of every patient that you're treating. Try to merge. I think what happens sometimes when you're an intern and a junior resident is that there are these didactic sessions that you attend where you're hearing lectures or you're trying to keep up reading the Schwartz textbook or whatever your favorite textbook is, and you're not learning in the specific context of the patients that you're taking care of. So what I used to try to do, and what I try to tell the residents to do, is try to learn something in the context of exactly who you're taking care of. There's always, whatever admission you're dealing with, there's going to be some aspect of that where there's an interesting question or a problem or something that would be a good idea to refresh on, whether it's the basic science behind fluid and electrolyte therapy when you're just writing simple IV fluid orders on somebody who's coming in with pancreatitis, to understanding exactly the anatomy of the operation that you're being asked to second assist on. So I think learning in the context of the patient that you're taking care of, that's really how to get the information to stick.
Well, sir, we can't thank you enough. I do have to ask you, though, did you play She's Only 17 with Kip Winger? Because I did have that album as a kid growing up.
No, so the thing about Winger songs, so Kip, he's a genius. The guy, he's amazing. He writes ballets. He's writes a classical composer, too. His stuff is actually amazingly difficult to play. But he's also likes to get down and dirty with it, and he'll jam on the Stones and the Beatles and everything else, and he's just a great guy.
That'd have been talent. Headed for Heartbreak, amongst other Winger favorites.
Right, right. It's all great stuff.
Well, we sure do appreciate you taking the time out. We know how busy you are, and this has been just a lot of fun. And truly want to thank, on behalf of all the listeners and the Twitter followers and everything, thanks for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it.
All right, that wraps it up for us today. It's time for our final count. Thanks for listening to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. We really enjoyed having Dr. Jeffrey Matthews of University of Chicago talk to us about chronic pancreatitis. Tune in next week with another great interview of some of the leaders in surgery. And we have a few episodes of note coming up. We're actually going to have an episode discussing the hashtag I Look Like a Surgeon, where we're going to have some of the leading female voices in surgery join us to talk about the future of women in surgery and what it's like being a leader female in the surgical world. We're going to have Patricia Turner, Amalia Cochran, and Sharon Stein, a few of the prestigious guests we're going to have on that episode, and we're really looking forward to it. Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.